Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Recently, Craig, you wrote in the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com, a vote for Ron DeSantis is a vote for hurricanes. What do you mean by that?
Well, not for hurricanes, but for Hurricane Ian. More stronger hurricanes, more hurricanes that rapidly intensify because in a warming world, which of course is the one we live in, Gulf of Mexico water is warmer, hurricanes rapidly intensify. Ian, for instance, started off Monday as a Category 1. It was a Category 4 and nearly a 5 when it hit Florida on Wednesday. So, but our governor is, he's willing to armor the coast and call it resilience, but he's not willing to do what he calls left-wing stuff to try and wean the state off fossil fuels or, you know, anything like that. So he's in that sort of climate denier mindset. He's even afraid to say the words climate change.
Yeah, he is as climate denial as you will find in 2022. And he is of this thinking that if you pretty much just put blinders up, that's the hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, and it'll just go away. And we can build our way out of this. Seawalls and dikes and levees and pumping stations and drainage. And instead of giving any attention whatsoever to trying to stem this off at the source and reduce the amount of carbon pollution we're emitting, he is on the developer side of, we'll just build our way out of this.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, and there are two problems with that. One is you're making the taxpayers pay for bad builder decisions to build in low-lying coastal areas. But number two, the problem with resilience, with focusing only on resilience, is that you have to keep doing it over and over and over again. You know, the sea level keeps getting higher. You got to build your seawalls higher. You got to raise the roads even more. So all the millions of dollars we're spending now, we're going to have to spend it all over again.
And it's a narrow perspective of resilience. His resilience is all concrete and asphalt. It's not about not building anymore. It's not about moving homes away from coastal areas. It's not about rebuilding dunes and seagrass beds and mangroves, which we're going to get into in this episode. It's not about natural green solutions. It's about how can I continue to pay huge dollars out of the state coffers to developers, contractors, road builders, and put up more concrete and asphalt in this state when time and time again, and we'll hear this from our guest, the best way to mitigate storm surge is through natural solutions, not more concrete.
Right. Well, and the other thing too is it doesn't do anything about the other impacts of climate change. You know, the heat is rising. It's hot even at night now. People have to work outdoors. I feel so bad for those folks. It's just brutal. And you know, the hurricane has brought in some cooler weather temporarily, but we're going to go right back to hot days and heavier rainfall pretty soon.
And these are not realities that the governor wants to deal with. You can read in the Florida Phoenix, Craig's commentary there about how a vote for Ron DeSantis is a vote for more Hurricane Ians. And we want to thank windstormproducts.com for sponsoring the podcast.
Speaking of hurricanes.
This is human nature, right? You know, everyone. Yeah. Oh, man, what was that thing on the Welcome to Florida again? So you go back and you were too late. And hey, none of this stuff, you know, if you're in Fort Myers Beach or Sanibel, is going to help a lot. I mean, from the most devastating, you know, if your roof blows off, there's nothing you can do about that. But where I am in Fernandina Beach, certainly, where Craig is in St. Pete, the impacts of Hurricane Ian on your home or business would have been dramatically different if you had used our friends with Windstorm Products, the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware. But the one that I'm finally seeing more and more people use, and it's those Quickdam water-activated flood barriers. I was walking out in my neighborhood and saw people with the sandbags. I'm thinking, this person drove all the way to like the municipal dump where there's a giant pile of sand in the rain, blowing wind, filled up these bags,
Stood in line for an hour.
Probably. Yeah, sat in the car in line for an hour, got all wet, got all filthy, car got wet, car got filthy, then came back home, set this stuff up. I can promise you, I've filled up sandbags. It is a arduous, sweaty, dirty, long process. And then you're left with all these sandbags. Right next door in one of these condo complexes, someone had the quick dam water activated flood barriers, which you receive in the mail, you open, you lay down in front of your property, and then you let them fill up with water while you go back inside and watch the NFL games. And then when they fill up with water, you poke a hole in them and discard them. Or if you don't end up using them, you just save them for the next time. I'm going to put a link to these in the show notes, folks. Again, a 12-foot storm surge, nothing's going to help. But if you've got that sunny day flooding or, constant, water inundation in your garage or in your basement, or if you're in a low-lying area and you're always worried about the next storm, getting water creeping into your house, Quick Dam water activated flood barriers, check it out in the show notes, and with our friends at windstormproducts.com, going to change your life. Okay, our guest today, Samantha Chapman, professor of biology at Villanova. Hey, now that's in Philadelphia, Craig. What are we doing talking to someone from Villanova today?
Well, she seems like the perfect person to talk to us about mangroves because she's been studying Florida mangroves for years. And in fact, I quoted her in a column back in 2020 talking about how the mangroves are adapting to climate change in Florida, whereas we're not doing so great. So that's why I figured she's a good expert to talk to about the role of mangroves in saving our coast and saving us.
I remember that column well and mention it to people all the time because mangroves are a South Florida native plant that is actually moving north because the weather is warming, moving north where they're not supposed to be. So it's the rare, almost native invasive plant. And that's what we're going to talk about. And like we mentioned, mangroves' ability to mitigate storm surge and hurricane impacts. Samantha Chapman is our guest. A quick note on the audio quality of this interview. About halfway through, we experienced some technical difficulties with a fuzz or a buzz on the line. That was only for a couple of minutes. We recorded this interview as Hurricane Ian had passed by St. Pete, but was still coming up the coast and affecting me in Fernandina Beach. So all of our Zoom connections were a little staticky for a moment, but bear with us and it gets better towards the end when we reconfigure our connection.
How does a professor at Villanova wind up studying mangroves in Florida?
It's a great question. So I was lucky enough, through some internet sleuthing, to come upon the research of my mentor and kind of the godmother, I would say, of mangrove research, Candy Feller, who is a Smithsonian scientist at the Smithsonian. And I still was just in the Keys with her 2 weeks ago working on these mangroves. I was lucky enough to meet her, and I ended up doing a little stint during graduate school where I went and hung out with her in Florida, in your lovely Florida, and did some research at Smithsonian Marine Station. And then she took me all around the world to see mangroves, and we still collaborate to this day. So yeah, I just had a good trainer, that's all.
What is it about Florida mangroves that you find so fascinating?
Yeah, as you may know from being in them probably better than I, you first get in there and you're sort of like, why am I in this crazy place, right? You can't see 2 feet in front of your face and you're sinking in mud up to your thighs. There could be any sort of animal right around the corner, but they're
you make it sound so attractive.
I know, I'm still doing it years later, right? I think fascinating, right? That these trees, I've always been a tree lover, hugger, but can like be perched in the water, right? With their feet in the water and deal with massive storm surges as salt water and all these things that trees aren't really supposed to be able to deal with, and they can. And so I just think they're totally fascinating.
Now there's more than one type of mangrove, right?
That's right. In the neotropics, so here we have three species, right? So in Florida, you have the black mangrove, the white mangrove, and the red mangrove, as they're commonly called, or there are three different species. Yeah, scientific names. If you want, I can tell you them. But
how are they different?
So they're different in the way that oftentimes their position along the coast. So oftentimes in Florida, you find the reds right along the edge, right along the water, with their big prop roots. Look like jungle gyms. You go through in a little kayak, right, and you see them really beautifully hanging over the water. Black mangroves have those cool little, what are called pneumatophores, or like little snorkels that stick up from the ground that help them breathe in flooded water. And white mangroves are sort of in between. They're kind of like more like orchard trees, right? They look more like trees than black and red mangroves do. So they're different in that way. They're also different in lots of other things. Like black mangroves are the ones that can tolerate freezing the best. And that's why they're the ones that we're studying that are most often moving further north and are now kind of perched right on the edge with Georgia, about to potentially, with this hurricane, spread up into that area of the U.S.
Let me ask you about that. So mangroves used to be a sort of a strictly Florida phenomenon, but they're moving.
Yeah, so there's some really good work that's been done recently by my colleague Candy and some other people looking at the historical range of mangroves in the U.S. and Florida, and they actually were up pretty far north in Florida back in the 1800s. So John Muir and Bartram and other people actually looked at them back then. But then because mangroves can't tolerate deep freezes, so like a couple nights in a row with really strong freezes, they were killed back. And then they would sort of come back again, and they'd be killed back again. And there's really good records in Florida, as you can imagine, on freeze events because of the citrus industry.
Sure.
And so it's cool that we have these really good records of freezes, as well as some, you know, naturalist observations of where mangroves were traditionally. Mangroves are now, as I said, the most northern mangrove that we found is right up on the edge of the border with Georgia. And that's kind of where the historical range are. But there are many more of them now than there were, let's say, in the 80s. For sure. They're moving up into areas, and they're not even just moving into further north, and they're also like spreading out, right? So they kind of take over the salt marsh that they're displacing. And this isn't just a U.S. thing that's happening in New Zealand. I've seen it. It's happening in China. It's happening in various parts of the world. It's because of lack of freeze events, these mangroves can now live in these other zones. They could also do this because the sea levels are higher, and they get kind of like in Australia, they get carried higher up on the coast. All kinds of ways that people are sort of letting this climate adaptation by plants happen, which is interesting.
Yeah, I live right on the Florida-Georgia border. I'm in Fernandina Beach, so I'm sure that's what you're talking about. And again, to me, to see a mangrove here would be so incongruous. It's like, what is that thing doing here? You know, that should be, you know, in Vero or someplace, not here. It would seem like, well, maybe this is a good thing. You know, it's a native plant. It's a barrier against storm surge. But you talked about mangroves going into salt marshes where they're not supposed to be. And that's where we run into trouble, I think.
Yeah, Chad, I think, you know, this is really one of the main goals of my research program is to figure out, you know, what does this mean? And of course, as you're saying, like, these species are pretty adaptive and plastic, and they can be in lots of different kinds of places. And I tend to think about this as the earth, plants in particular, finding a way to adapt to climate change. So I think we can learn a lot from it. I don't necessarily think it's a good or, like, you know, one good thing is that we know mangroves are better at absorbing storm surges than marshes are.
Right.
So we've seen this, and that you need less mangroves than you do of marsh to take down a big wave, right? So that's one good thing. Obviously, the animals that associate with these plants are different, although it's been shown that some of the birds and other things and fish that do well in marshes can also do well in mangroves. But as you say, you know, there's a big part of this that's like we're not used to seeing mangroves all along the vast, you know, coast, it's gorgeous area where you live by Fernandina Beach. It's just different, right? And so, you know, what does that do to people's perspective on that and their aesthetics of what their coastlines look like? So I think that there are some good things about this climate adaptation, but there's also some things like, what if all the mangroves take over and then there's a deep freeze, right? Then what? So what we start to think about it now is it's kind of like this more diverse place where you have both marshes and mangroves, and they're kind of like shifting back and forth a bit. And if you have both of them, then maybe that's the best case scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would be one thing if these adaptations were the result of some sort of natural phenomenon. I guess, you know, obviously climate change is a natural phenomenon, but is a man-made natural phenomenon. So that's right. where I sort of run into trouble thinking, yeah, I mean, it's the old Jeff Goldblum life finds a way kind of thing, right? Okay, great. And these aren't native plants, and I'm in the Native Plant Society and trees and all. Okay, that's great. At the same time, they're being forced, not the word, but they're taking advantage of man-made conditions to go where they haven't been previously.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there is no, it's like watching climate change happen. And what I would say in my state and your state and all these places, we're like trying to resist climate change. And I guess I would say like we have to find ways to adapt to climate change because it's here and rising sea levels. Even if, you know, these great new bills we have are going to help us with emissions reduction and natural climate change solutions. But I would say that a lot of the sea level rise is already baked into the system, as you both know.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, we're all, you know, the three of us are of an age where when climate change started to begin, when it was global warming, you know, right? And then that became non-politically correct and a culture war buzzword. It was such an opaque 50 years off, 2050. We, like you mentioned now, Samantha, climate change is occurring in real time, whether it's the hurricanes. And again, you're not going to watch a mangrove grow in real time, but In the context of natural adaptation, something you see over your lifetime is essentially real time.
Well, and how quickly have they colonized this far north?
So I'll just give you an example. Like at Kennedy Space Center, they increased by, you know, 70% in abundance in just like a decade, right? And that's not like moving miles north. That's just like filling in, right, in that area. And again, they were there before and they got killed back, but they're moving really fast. But the thing that spreads them the best is high water events and hurricanes. And so it's very interesting.
Irma. So the more hurricanes we have that bring big storm surges, the farther north.
Yeah. And one thing we just saw 2 weeks ago, and this is no accident, right? Mangroves have evolved to do this, that they're dropping their propagules, right? Which are like little alive, little trees that are kind of like seeds, but not exactly. But right now, that's when they're dropping, and they're dropping them during hurricane season and during high water events and king tides and things like that. And that's when they tend to end up spreading, right? Because they're carried by high water, as you said, Craig.
And that could be, you know, 100 miles. You know, you think of a little seed pod on a hurricane, you know, water that could go.
Yeah, there's actually a really cool study where they found that some of the populations in Northeast Florida, where I do most of my work, were actually came from the West Coast. And like, they're genetically similar to them. They're most similar to them, so they must come all the way.
So was it, well, did the water carry them, or were they carried by the wind then?
Yeah, the water carries them, right? So the red mangroves, you've probably seen them, right? Those big, long propagules. The black ones are like smaller and more round. And so they get carried along on currents. Actually, sort of, they get carried in the sargassum, some of the seagrass and things like that as they move in the like big currents. And then high water events and storm surges sort of pushes them inland, and they can get up and into the marsh on these, you know, king tides and surges and things like that. Yeah.
So what are some things that people don't know about mangroves? And I'm thinking in particular, what would you say to the folks who are all constantly saying, we have to cut the mangroves back so we can have our water view?
I know, I hear you. And, you know, I do love this about Florida that, you know, and I was looking this up this morning because I wanted to make sure I got it right. But like Florida does have really strict regulations of dealing with mangroves. Now, as you said, you can trim them because you want your water view and you have to hire someone, but like compared to other places I've been, like New Zealand, you know, they have these mangroves invading and they just want them out of there and they just cut them down, right? They just take them out.
Really?
So what I would say is that the coolest thing to me, and this is something I can't stop studying, even though I'm kind of beating it over and over again, but is the ability of these systems to literally like keep up with sea level rise, right? They like build land. And there's lots of ways they do this, but like along the coast in the Northeast where I work, they essentially grow roots and they trap sediment. And in doing so over time, that stuff doesn't decompose because there's no oxygen or little oxygen getting into it. And so it just builds land over and over and over. And we can watch through these measurements that we do how much land they build. And so one of the things we're trying to figure out is like, how does a marsh versus a mangrove? Because marshes do this too, build land. And it seems like mangroves tend to build land potentially in one of our studies, you know, faster than marshes do. So maybe that helps Florida and these places with keeping up with sea level rise.
I'm not sure the property owners on the beach are going to like that though. They're like, wait, you mean you're pushing the water further out? This is land that I don't know.
But they're so well anchored and deeply anchored as trees are. I know a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, but I think it's becoming more prevalent to see mangroves and green infrastructure, seagrass and dune restorations being used as a sea level rise and flooding mitigator, as opposed to just more concrete and seawalls. And you know, mangroves may block your view, but they're a damn sight more attractive than a 5-foot concrete wall along the ocean front.
Yeah, what do they call it? Living coastlines? Is that the term of art these days?
Yep. Yeah. Oyster reefs and mangroves and marshes. Yeah, you're totally right. And these green barriers, like, they've been working for us for long periods of time, right? In some ways, the developing world caught on to this faster than we did. Like, after the Asian tsunami, where, like, people that lived behind mangroves lived, and people that where their mangroves have been cleared because of shrimp farming or whatever died. So that, you know, India and other places are like, you know, years ago now, are like, we got to restore all these mangroves.
Yeah.
That's a pretty clear study.
If we want to go back in time, I think the greatest failure of Hurricane Katrina was the failure to recognize this. The failure to recognize that, look, we've got a chance here to turn the entire Gulf Coast essentially into a resilient living coastline. And the Bush administration just utterly failed to do any of that work. Of that administration's failures, and there are countless, that was one that was so obvious. And what you realize too with these living seashores, obviously they're much better for all the other animals. You know, what is a manatee going to do with a levee? Nothing. But with a mangrove, absolutely. And when you look at the cost, much cheaper way to go about this than bringing in all the bulldozers and the cement mixers and trying to build walls. But there's a party, a political party in this country that loves building walls, and it is extended to the ocean and the Gulf.
That's a great point. All that BP money, right?
Yeah.
Has some of it now starting to go into that stuff, Chad, but I totally agree with you. Like, and it's good for fishing and your economies that you have. Baby fish live in the marshes and live in the mangroves, and then they go out to the ocean, right? So
Yeah.
What are some of the animals that take shelter in the mangroves and use them as nurseries and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, small fish are a huge one, right? They literally are like the nurseries of the sea. All the baby fish, when they're born, many hide inside the mangrove roots, and because they're, you know, less likely to get eaten by big fish or bird predators or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so then after they grow up, they often go out into the ocean. So mangroves are known to be incredibly important for fisheries. Yeah, they're really, really important for that. But yeah, other cool animals, you know, we definitely see crazy snakes and beautiful spiders. Yeah, and amazing birds, of course, like you have.
Crustaceans too, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, cool sponges on the roots. The mangrove tree crab is adorable. They're cannibalistic, but they're really, really cute.
wait a minute. Ballistic, what do you mean?
Yeah,
have you had a bad encounter with one?
They're very small, luckily. But no, they're really crazy because they're omnivores. They'll eat like leaves, and they'll eat each other's babies. They eat anything. And they're just like, you go into a mangrove and they just like scatter everywhere, right? They're all hanging out. They're really cool.
So we've talked a lot about the Atlantic coast and mangroves there. What's going on the Gulf Coast? Are the mangroves moving northward there as well?
The mangroves are moving northward there as well. And they've been, there's some recent people that have been working in near Mexico Beach, where there was also another hurricane. They're also moving into Gulf Coast marshes in Texas, like Port Aransas. And there was a deep freeze there this past winter that killed off a bunch of those mangroves. They're tending to recolonize in some sites, but not other sites. And so it's a really interesting situation, kind of testing the situation of, like, you know, what happens if the mangroves all move in and then it freezes? So I'm really watching those results to see what happens.
We're talking about mangroves migrating naturally, but what about cultivation? Is it an easy tree to grow, like in South Florida or the Keys or someplace, if they wanted to do a living shoreline and incorporate mangroves? Do you plant that like a sapling, like it's an elm tree, or you know, how does that work?
Yeah, you know, Chad, it's just like those, we were talking about those floating seeds, those propagules. Mm-hmm. They are really easy to plant because the plant's already germinated, essentially. And so as long as you get the tidal regime right and the hydrological flushing, like the flushing of water into and out of the system, they can grow really well. So you have to mm-hmm. plant them at the right elevation. You can't do it on like a mud flat, which is like a natural mud flat, which has been done in a lot of places and failed, you know, mangrove restoration has happened because of that. But there's actually some studies that show that Florida has some of the best area to restore for mangroves in the world. And if you do that, you know, maybe like something like 200 square kilometers or something. If you do that, you get, you know, all the benefits of these green barriers to protect people in inland, also all the fishing benefits, and you get a ton of carbon scrubbed out of the atmosphere by these ecosystems. So it's really a win-win for these in areas where mangroves are naturally growing to, you know, restore them.
Yeah, we hadn't even, I hadn't even thought about that, talking about how they, like any other tree, will filter the air for carbon dioxide. So again, unlike your seawall that does nothing to help climate change and in fact exacerbates it because concrete production is such a major factor in carbon dioxide pollution. Right. The trees are, you know, this is it's not carbon neutral, it's carbon negative. And, you know, in these mangrove ecological communities, are there typically other plant species? We talked about the fish and the crabs and the spiders and snakes and that kind of thing, but any other hanger-on or plant species that tend to find their way into these mangrove forests?
Yeah, there's all kinds of really cool bromeliads, right, that grow in mangroves, plants that kind of grow up in the mangroves themselves. And in some of the really deep tropical mangroves, you can find a lot of that. Really, there's other little species of plants that can kind of grow amongst the mangroves, little succulent things. There's lots of diversity in these systems, even though people think of them kind of like, you know, backwater swamps. They're really amazing in terms of their biodiversity. And the blue carbon piece, like that's what's being called, is like blue carbon, right? Any carbon that is coming, that's being sucked up like in oceanic ecosystems, like mangroves and seagrasses, is huge. They actually, mangroves do this better, take carbon out of the atmosphere 5 times better than terrestrial forests like we have here in Pennsylvania. So they do a really good job of it. Yep.
Why is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the same reason that they're good at building land. Like you can kind of think about that land that they're building underneath them as a bunch of carbon. It just gets locked away, right, in the soil, and it doesn't come back out. Whereas like a forest, like a deciduous forest here in Pennsylvania, that carbon's always being respired from the roots. In mangroves, that carbon's building up and up over time in the soil. And in doing so, it's just sitting there for thousands of years. And like, you know, Belize and Panama, you can find these mangrove peat things that go down for thousands of years. It's just carbon locked away. It's really amazing.
Wow. So if people uproot the mangroves, does that release the carbon back into the atmosphere again?
Sure does. Yep. Especially if you don't have it being put back in, right? And you know, obviously when you drain anything, you put oxygen into that, right? Because the water's not there anymore. And then that oxidizes all that carbon, it blows off into the atmosphere. So, you know, estimates that we've lost 50% of mangroves that were once around, you know, at a faster rate of deforestation, or it was in the past in tropical rainforest, shows that we've lost a lot of carbon from these ecosystems already.
Yeah. Is that 50% figure, is that globally or here in Florida? And what would it be?
That's globally.
Yeah,
you know, that is a good question. So, I mean, I know that mangroves started to be protected in Florida, you know, kind of in the 80s, but like the 50s and 60s, right, where you were places like Coral Gables and other places where it were essentially wetlands, right, that were drained and filled, there was a lot of mangrove loss. And I think that's where that number comes in, that there's a lot of mangroves that could be restored, not necessarily where people are living right now, right, but in other places because they've been lost. And even in places like Marco Island, you could plant mangroves. Like there's this cool study, you could, if you restored like flushing, you know, the tidal flushing of kind of right along the edges of where the neighborhoods are, you could get mangroves back in those areas. You just need the right conditions. And that would be very helpful, as you can imagine, for those people with dealing with coastal protection.
Yeah. And I guess this is just my, you know, sort of narrow-mindedness. I think of mangroves as a coastal species, but I do not think of them inland wetland, but, you know, obviously mangroves anywhere it's wet, I would imagine, you know, swampy and sustained wet, but only saltwater.
So they grow in freshwater too really well. And I know this because we grow them in the greenhouse here sometimes in freshwater, and they do really well along the Amazon. They do really well, places like that. One thing that's happening in Florida too is in the Everglades, as the sea levels are coming up and there's more salt water getting into the Everglades, the mangroves can then outcompete some of the freshwater plants and are moving up into those areas as well. So they're kind of like migrating up the river of grass, so to speak.
You've visited mangroves all over the East Coast, at least. What's your favorite place to go canoeing or kayaking among the mangroves? Where would you send people who wanted a good mangrove experience?
I would say actually one of the coolest places is Rookery Bay, which is on the West Coast, and that's a National Estuarine Research Reserve. So they have some amazing mangroves there that were saved pretty much right after Marco Island was built. A bunch of scientists were like, you know, these mangroves are really important for the fish that we have in these waterways. We need to do something about this. And so those are some really gorgeous mangroves. You can get up in there, like you say, in a kayak and kind of kayak around. I was just in the mangroves in the Keys, and those are totally different, right? Some of them are really small, but they're hundreds of years, 100 years old or so, because there's no nutrients and they're growing on like old coral, right? Yeah, so those are really beautiful places to go to.
Samantha Chapman, professor of biology at Villanova and a mangrove researcher here in Florida, thank you for your time and sharing your wisdom about this fascinating tree with us today.
For sure. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoy all of your work and been following it closely.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks again. This has been a great conversation. We appreciate it.
Yep.
Tell the crabs we said hello.
Will do.
I'll have to keep an eye out, Craig, for that mangrove here by me in Fernandina Beach. And what a strange sight that would be for me to see. And again, this sort of speaks to this Franken landscape we have here in Florida because of human interventions, whether that's invasive species or whether it's development or whether now, you know, climate change. It's a real jigsaw puzzle with a lot of pieces removed and a lot of pieces in the puzzle that are not supposed to be in this puzzle.
Well, I'm glad you asked about planting them, because I read a story, I think it was in the Fort Myers News Press recently, about a set of twins who were running a nursery and are actually growing mangroves that they're taking out to replant in areas where they had been removed. And they're doing this specifically to try and combat climate change.
It's love
their,
that. Yeah.
Their and small contribution. To,
sure.
To
and I know that the Nature Conservancy has programs in South Florida on the Atlantic side, planting mangroves as living shoreline. And, you know, even little Fernandina Beach here talking about what to do with our marina area, you know, living shorelines. I'm glad you brought that up, because, again, and this circles us back to the start of the podcast. And that's where we're at. You know, concrete, asphalt, that's how we got ourselves into this damn problem. You know, we need to figure out how to use nature like mangroves and oyster beds and seagrass beds to combat the fury of nature that we've unleashed upon us.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome to Florida. To Florida.